serious disabling injuries on the job, who are killed or suffer serious disabling injury.
They're going to have to define it.
Well, that's, but I think that is appropriate. That gives the director direction as to what we're, you know, and there may be cases where a partial disability for one person is much more serious than for another in terms of their ability to pay for the children's education.
Would a starter be killed or permanently totally disabled? Very fairly narrow group, and then see how it works.
I would go serious.
I have one thought. Is, you know what's going to happen if we start using something like that? We're going to see 100 pages of administrative rules defining. Well, 10 pages. Defining who is seriously disabled for purposes of being able to apply. But now, it's clean if you say who have received a permanent disability award, because either you got an award or you didn't get an award. And then we don't have to have any rules defining it. I'm not just saying permanently, who are killed or who have received a permanent disability award.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
If I can change, just for a second at least, the direction of this conversation. I have a real hard time. I'm all in favor of commemorating people who've been killed in the workplace. And I think we had a bill earlier to make November the Labor Month, and that deals largely with the numbers of people who've been killed during the month of November and labor disputes and things. But when we're wrestling with issues about throwing people out of nursing homes because we don't have enough money, even though this is a very small amount, it still, on principle, seems to be not a wise use of money in a year when we don't have near enough to go around. And conversely, the small amount of money that's involved here, as far as having any real beneficial effect on a scholarship or anything else, is so negligible that it's probably not worth the administrative cost to administer the thing. Interest on $25,000, the witness the other day said maybe $2,000 a year. I don't know who's going to be keeping track of this or making decisions as to where the money's going and who's going to write the checks and all that stuff, but it seems to me like administrative cost to the state of administering this thing is probably going to be $2,000 a year. So we're really just doing a symbolic thing with this bill that maybe isn't appropriate in this year when there's no money.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
I'd like to propose that, remember, we're not focusing so much on the worker as the child of the worker in terms of the recipient. That's why I didn't mind having a broader pool of potential applicants. And if we said killed on the job or have received a permanent disability award, we have a defined universe of potential applicants. If it turns out that the administrators of the fund get 10,000 applications the first year, they can come back and then maybe we'll set a higher standard as to who can apply. But I'd like the idea of just starting out and saying, all right, you got a permanent disability award or the worker was killed, you can apply for the scholarship. And there may, but to me, when I was in school, a few $100 scholarship in a given year was made all the difference. I remember I ended up needing, in any given year in college and law school, besides my own income, two or three small scholarships to help me get by. And I remember one of them was $250. But it sure was well appreciated. And granted, today it probably have to be $600 to be the equivalent amount, but it was well appreciated. And if we can just light a little candle in one little corner somewhere, one of those good little bills.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
On the bill, and I don't know, I don't think we ever got the amendment completed yet, but I think what we're talking about doing is using penalty money, and there's no better place to put penalty money is to put in some kind of recognition for injured workers. So I think that we're talking about something that's very important to show some people that the state cared about a father or a mother who was lost or permanently injured in the workplace. And that's all we're doing, is we're showing some recognition to the family that the state cares.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'll move to amend the amendment in front of us so that, just to get us going on this, so it would read, children of workers who are killed on the job or have received or whoever received a permanent disability award.
And I guess we could say the definition of would, a child would be
anyone under the age of, well,
anyone that isn't a child described in the it's an adopted child or a foster child.
I think it'd be the standard understanding of a family member, and I wouldn't put an age limit because there may be someone who's in college or.
It's not going to take 10 pages to describe what the child is. Okay. Right.
It will, mine, but it shouldn't.
Okay. Is there any objections to the amendment?
As modified.
As modified. Okay, we'll accept those amendments.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I have another suggestion, and because the bill doesn't address who is going to make the decision about how the money is going to be administered, it just says the director shall. And we have already adopted in this state, we have a state advisory committee on safety and health, and I'd like to suggest a new section, whatever it ends up being, 3, 4, that would say the State Advisory Committee on Safety and Health shall adopt rules and make yearly recommendations to the Department of Insurance and Finance for the Worker Memorial Scholarship account. I think we have to have some place to do the interviewing, all of those kinds of things. We have an advisory committee that meets quarterly to talk about safety and health, and I think maybe this might be the appropriate place to initiate. Irv is going ballistic on me. Well,
okay. You've heard the amendment. Is there any discussion?
I don't, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Could I get Irv Fletcher to come up? He seems to think it's already in here.
I don't know if we can stop him.
Come on
down. Only an advisory,
Mr.
Chair. I'm looking at the A. Engross version, and it says the director shall consult with the Safe Employment Education and Training Advisory Committee.
But the report that we have in front of us has just replaced that section 2 with the scholarship fund, and it looks like we need to put back in something as to that. I think that's Representative Dominey's point.
Couldn't you just insert the section 2 again?
Yeah, I think we can play with this for a minute. I think we can take care of it.
I guess I don't have a... as I seen the amendments, we didn't have a place to do this.
This got taken out with,
yeah,
with
yeah,
the
I
amendment.
I got something here, Mr. Chairman.
And I just wanted to make sure somebody was doing it.
Well, conferring with the employer member on that committee, I think he concurs that we would like to see this committee, which is involved in that advisory capacity already, remain.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
That would be our advisory to you.
Can do it.
Okay.
Got a motion.
Amanda can do it.
I'll remove my. No. Well, go ahead.
This will just be a friendly amendment to your amendment.
Okay.
And that is that we'll change what we just made section 2 to be a section 2 sub 1, and we will go back to the bill, and what is section 2 sub 2? We'll reinstate it with a slight change. So it would read, the director shall consult with the Safe Employment Education and Training Advisory Committee established pursuant to RS 654189. In determining the appropriate scholarship standards and in selecting the recipients.
Great.
Period.
Great.
Are those conceptual enough that we'll need to wait to get that actually?
They're
going to
have a bill.
It's
okay.
We got to send it to Ways and Means anyway. Okay. $25,000.
All right.
Is $25,000 the threshold?
$5,000.
$20.
Okay. Is there any objections to the amendment?
Requirement.
Recipients. You will accept the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Move the bill's amended to Ways and Means.
All right. Motion has been made to send the bill to Ways and Means with a due-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, just in light of the comments I made earlier, if Ways and Means is going to make a determination on the money, and if they determine that there is money available for something like this, that's fine for me. I didn't know that we were going to be referring it to them, so I thought it was our responsibility to make that money determination. If it's not, then fine, let's vote it out.
Okay.
That's why they get paid the big bucks.
You want to call the roll, please?
It's not a prior subsequent referral. This would be, this would
Do you need to vote to adopt these amended amendments?
We've
There's
accepted.
Still a motion on
the They're accepted
We have
without
accepted
objection.
The amendments.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
For the record, though, I have moved now with those amendments, the bill, as amended to two ways and means with the due pass.
Okay. Thank you.
It was not a prior subsequent referral for your information.
No, but we
Just
are
to let
appropriating
you know.
$25,000. So.
I think,
Mr.
That if we Mr. go down and handle that, I think we can get it through.
I think we can get it out here quick.
Okay, would you call a roll, please?
Representative Pine?
Aye.
Representative Watt?
Aye.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Dominic?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative Durkla?
Aye. It carries. We're going to take about a 15-minute break because we have to gather up a few people, and we're going to go on into the next bill.
Bill
3579.
Oh.
You've got
to
find
the
amendments
and find the blood.
Okay.
You know, back.
A public hearing on a work session on House Bill 3579. And we have someone from the governor's office that would like to come up and see. I should probably be careful how I put this. Express the position of the governor at this particular point. Is that a polite way of putting it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Members of the committee.
It's the first time we've had the opportunity of having the governor's office here.
On this bill.
Well, on this bill. The governor's office has been here numerous times.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Terry Rogers. I'm the governor's legislative coordinator, and I do appreciate the opportunity to just say a few brief words. I know it is work session. And basically, I would like to make it clear that one of the governor's highest priorities this entire session has been the proper funding of the welfare reform program, which has been before this committee in a number of ways. The history of the welfare reform program that is running now is a very long one. In 1981, the Adult and Family Services Division worked on a mandatory work search program, which continued through 1987. They have much experience in placing welfare recipients in minimum wage jobs, and they found that that was simply a revolving door with welfare. That an enormously high percentage of the recipients would be back on the caseload within the year due to problems with medical care for children, all kinds of problems, but they found that it did not work. Since 1987, the legislature funded essentially in a demonstration project, and then we have expanded the funding, but only slightly. We still only have between a quarter and a third of the caseload able to be in the welfare reform program, which is a program dedicated to training and placing for those who don't need training, welfare recipients, not only so that they can be in the workforce, but also so that they can get out of poverty. And we do not see this bill as particularly consistent with those efforts. The governor is not in favor of the bill, and we would like to see this legislature try to fund at an adequate level the welfare reform program that we have been working on that we do think is successful. And I appreciate the opportunity to let the committee know what the governor's position is.
Yeah, we do appreciate that, but I'd like, you did bring up a point saying that placing people in minimum wage jobs doesn't solve the problem, and I totally agree with you. And I think the direction that this bill is taking is hopefully would not do that. I don't think this particular bill is trying to get people to work for McDonald's or for Dairy Queen or the minimum wage jobs. I think I envision this program that we can go to responsible employers in the area and ask them to take some of these people who have been on welfare programs for a long time and ask them to bring those people in and help train them so that they can go up into a higher paying job. I think that's what we're trying to accomplish with the bill. Is we're not trying to get people just in the minimum wage jobs. We're trying to get them into training programs, and we're trying to bring business along with us and encouraging business to help us get these people off the welfare rolls and into higher paying jobs.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that legislation would be needed for that. The federal law and state law provides for on-the-job training now, and certainly there could be more emphasis on that. That is an area that the welfare department is allowed to pursue now, does pursue. It's not easy to gain the cooperation, but it is certainly something that under current law they are able to do.
Okay. Well, I'm disappointed that the governor isn't at least wanting to look at a new idea, a new thought. So I guess I would have to express my disappointment in that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to know how the governor would respond to the majority of the people who passed ballot measure number 7 last November in light of that.
Governor Goldschmidt sent in December, I think, of 1990 a letter to the Congress following the law, that the Measure 7, which became law, requesting the waivers. It is my understanding from the testimony before this committee that those waivers, or some, will not be able to be granted. So Governor Roberts feels that the gubernatorial obligation has been met. She came out during her campaign against Measure 7. Obviously, when it became law, she was required, or Goldschmidt, as governor, was required to request the waivers. So I think that the role of the governor's office has been satisfied.
That doesn't really answer my question, though. How would the governor respond to the will of the people, the majority of the people who passed the ballot measure, not whether it meets federal standards? I think that we have a plan here that we can very successfully meet those waivers.
I'm not sure that what is being discussed by this committee is the will of the people. Measure 7 certainly expressed the will of the people in that it received a majority of the votes and was passed. The governor's interest is in seeing that welfare reform is successful and receives a priority from her perspective.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming.
Yes, you do. Gentlemen, what Mr. Campbell's handing out to you is a Hannon Gross copy of the Dash 2 amendments. The Hannon Grossments are technical refinements that weren't incorporated into the Dash 2 amendments. And they address a couple of issues that were raised at the prior hearing. I'll let Representative Mannix address the hard copy. I'll address what I wrote in. The first little star on line 12, it says delete 18, delete 19. I know that means nothing to you, but the effect that has, one of the issues that was raised during the hearing is the age of the children, and this would raise the age of that's eligible under this bill from 18 through 19. The second Hannon Gross amendment is further down on the page. It says substitute insert 1. Insert 1 is on this other page. And what that is just it recites to the point the federal law with regard to conditioning employment and having it affect somebody who may have to refrain from joining a labor union or not. It's just precise language if in the future they do seek UI waivers. On the second page of the hard copy of the Hannon Gross amendments, it says in line 23 after B, insert at least. This addresses the issue of the language of the bill saying that all wages must be 90% of minimum wage. That established an artificial ceiling and basically overruled the part of the ballot measure that allowed skilled labor to be offset. And so this means that no, they will get no less than 90% minimum wage. They still are allowed to pay skilled labor above that as provided within the ballot measure. And then the final change would be on the last page, and these would be technical modifications to the ballot measure itself as it relates to unemployment compensation so that it's consistent with your intent to take the UI taxing out. Now I'll let you talk about the hard copy.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
first to get us to discussion phase, I'm going to move the dash two amendments incorporating the hand and gross changes just discussed by council, as well as the changes presented on the sheet that reads proposed amendments HB 3579. With one correction, I see it says, as a condition of being employed, the individual would be required to joining, it should be to join a company union. I'll just present that motion, then explain it, if I may.
Okay.
To the motion, Mr. Chairman. Those hand and gross changes incorporate a set of changes that were previously agreed upon, and we just didn't have formal legislative, I don't mean by the committee, I mean by proponents and others, as to changes that ought to be made in this act. As to the meat of the dash two amendments, I think it's important to point out that the first thing we're doing is we're saying we're trying to clarify and implement Measure 7. But if there's a conflict, this act is going to control. That's important because it puts us in the driver's seat as to what's going to happen in the future. I think we've recognized from what's happened with Measure 7 that we need to have people with expertise in the driver's seat rather than just the mushy feel-good measure itself. And this puts this act in the driver's seat. I think it's also important to note then that in Section 12 here on these dash two amendments or these changes, we're making it clear that we don't want to affect the unemployment compensation program in the state in the next biennium. While we're not excluding potential application in the future in subsequent biennia, that's something we can address every session anyway, we are excluding application in this biennium, and that's a pretty clear statement. And since this act controls, that would take care of any argument that Measure 7 somehow is going to affect unemployment compensation. I'd like to switch then to the last page, Section 21. I think that's the driving part of these dash two amendments. It makes it clear that we're looking for fair and efficient implementation of the act, but we expect the executive branch and its agencies to be innovative and flexible. And we want to make it clear, too, that because we're dealing with a complex area, that the directives of this act are not intended to be so binding as to interfere with the ultimate goal of this act, which is job placement. Let's remember what we're supposed to be here for. The second part of that is also important because we then recognize the complexity of all the laws, and we know we may not get waivers. We then say what our intention is, so it's clear as a bell in terms of any interpretation of what we're doing. The governor, by executive order, may approve alternative programs and methodologies to achieve the ultimate goal. So if you run into a roadblock, you don't just stand there. You can say, well, we're looking for job placement, ladies and gentlemen. Let's back up and go to the left or go to the right and go around the roadblock. It's intended to put some bumpers here so we can try to get to the job placement part, which is what this is supposed to be all about. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, who's the author of these dash twos?
The actual dash twos themselves, mm-hmm.
Without the hand of gross changes,
are my work product working with Kathleen Buffet and Legislative Council based on a meeting yesterday with a couple of executive branch folks, the chair of this committee, and the proponents of Measure 7. And the proponents of Measure 7 at the end of that meeting said, we didn't have the draft in front of us, of course, said they agreed with the concepts that were incorporated into these amendments. And some of this language is language I actually used during that discussion.
Okay, I'd like to address the last section, Section 21, that you just addressed. I appreciate the thought that we need to give some power to be flexible and also make a directive that we want the governor to not ignore this if she runs into something she steps her toe on and implementing this thing. On the other hand, I'm concerned that the words are maybe a little bit too broad and that they may give her the power to just ignore everything we've got in this bill and say, well, all I have to do is, as long as I'm working on any kind of program that's halfway related to job placement, I'm free to ignore this whole bill. And I don't know that we want to give her that much power.
Do you want to say where such waiver requests have been refused, the governor, by executive order?
The thing that comes to mind is a clause you see in contracts about severability. You know, I'm not suggesting that language necessarily, but the concept is that we want her to enforce every bit of this bill she can, and only if, and to the extent necessary, only if she has a specific problem, and then only to the extent necessary to cure that specific problem, is she authorized to deviate from the provisions of this bill.
All right, then the governor by executive order, I'm just trying to think of some language here, that where this act may not be implemented because of a refusal of the waiver, the governor may by executive order.
Can we put the phrase to the extent necessary somewhere in there? So that we're given the power to...
To the extent necessary to overcome a refusal of a waiver?
Right. To the extent necessary to overcome a waiver problem, she may modify the provisions of this bill. So that it's a limited power.
All right, may I say this? It is the intention of the Legislative Assembly that the governor, comma, to the extent necessary to overcome a refusal of a waiver request, comma, may by executive order approve. Would that do it?
Right, that would help.
I would incorporate that in the amendment, as a friendly amendment, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Accepted.
I have nothing else to offer except to ask if folks are willing to approve the amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a couple of questions, for clarification. First, we still have a sub-minimum wage ability in this bill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Secondly, there's nothing in this bill to prohibit Joe's supermarket that is on strike and decides that they would like to hire a couple of people and pay them 90% of minimum wage. There's nothing in this bill to stop them from having to go to work and go across that picket line.
Well, I think that the bill does address the labor dispute.
No, as it deals with unemployment insurance. It does not deal with anything other than unemployment insurance, the way I read it.
Okay.
So, I don't see anything in this bill that would exclude that. I mean, Kevin, Representative Mannix, you don't have anything?
No, I don't.
Okay. So, I will probably vote for the amendments, but I'll still have a problem with the bill with those two problems.
Would you like to come up with language that would not allow that, Representative Donovan?
I would move that no one under this act would be required cross a picket line.
It's not very hard.
Wait a minute.
Well, I don't.
Yeah, Sam and I went to the same school.
Whatever it takes to get that accomplished.
No person shall be required to accept employment where
a labor dispute
is in progress.
That would help.
I wouldn't have a problem with that.
What was wrong with the other language that we had?
It's limited to unemployment comp, which is now being
struck. No. I mean the language that said no one who participates in this program would be required to join a union or...
It's just if that was for the people who would be receiving UI benefits. That provision was only for those people because there was federal component.
Yeah, I understand
that's what's
that.
Wrong with it.
Well,
it's
couldn't
specific.
We broaden that?
What?
No, not if you ever want to go back and get your UI waiver going separately.
Because later you can do it.
That's
next biennium, you can do it.
That's clear. I mean, that's succinct to that particular direction for federal waivers.
Okay. Do you have the wording down?
I'm writing it down right now.
You could use this no first one, shall be applicable, you know, and use part of it.
We could have a separate section
right. That
says no person eligible for benefits under this act shall be offered a full employment program job that is subject to any of the following conditions. And use the same conditions again. And that'd be another one that's a general statement for all purposes. And we have the other one that's specific for unemployment just to keep the feds happy on the unemployment side. Does council understand that? I would join with Representative Domini in supporting that as an amendment, and it'd be a new section, and it would read, no person eligible for benefits under this act getting that?
Yep, I got it.
Shall be offered a full employment program job that is subject to any of the following conditions. The job is vacant due to a strike, lockout, or labor dispute. The remuneration, hours, or conditions of employment offered are substantially less favorable to the individual in comparison to other comparable work in the community.
Don't leave
that. Period. Then we have the special language.
Yeah, right.
That we've come up with. If, as a condition of being employed, the individual would be required to join a company union or be required to resign from or refrain from joining a bona fide labor organization.
Okay.
Now, did we end up with language then that makes it so that the all jobs that are subject to a strike are just totally out of, just not available, or do we make it so that the person who's being given the choice of this job has the option of choosing whether or not to pass the picket line? I mean, the conception of those are different things.
I guess we could change it to say, for this specific section, shall be required to take. Because if someone wants to, I guess it's their business.
I would rather leave it as it is.
Where the state.
I don't believe the state should be funding the program.
I don't think that.
I don't think we want the state involved in labor disputes. Period.
Okay. I just want to make clear how we end up on that because we're different.
I appreciate what you're saying, but I think that'd be.
That's fine.
Okay.
So that's a combination amendment now. Dash 2 with the hand of Gross plus the, I add as a friendly amendment, Representative Dominey's amendment.
Okay. Okay.